Now we're going to go to Josh Crosby. Josh, exactly where are you at the moment?
Well, I'm outside the convention centre in West Palm Beach, Pat. And this is where Donald Trump would have been holding his watch party and where he made his speech declaring a victory. And definitely a different mood here in the air than where Barry is. It's just gone 4 a.m., but the atmosphere here that's been lingering all night, like in the past 2 hours, there have been thousands of people on the street making their way from the convention centre, and their fans are there, they're waving their flags in the air, the cars are revving up and beeping. There's police everywhere, they've barricaded off the streets to try to control the crowds, and Trump fans have come from all over to be here tonight, Pat. Like, we'll hear from one man who travelled from Melbourne to be here, I met a man who came from the Philippines, another guy from Norway. And look, it is historic, Pat, and those here are going to be soaking it up. Let's take a listen now to Jimmy Holderfield and his wife, Pam. Jimmy tells me about the outfit he's wearing and why they voted for Trump.
Well, I'm showing that I'm a garbage man. I pick up trash. I'm a retired policeman, and I'm also secretary of the National Police Union. So I'm here to support our president, Donald Trump.
We have to get back to a man that will get up in the morning and pray over his cereal for our country.
Josh, tell me, there's groups out there working with men who assault their partners.
There are, Kieran. And look, it's not something we hear a lot about due to the sensitivity around this, but there are services that will work with survivors, victims, and also the perpetrators. They'll hold one-on-one sessions, weekly group meetings, and counselling for couples. One group, Move Ireland, runs a number of services. One of its main outlets would be the Choices Programme, and a lot of the work here would focus on cognitive behavioural therapy, which I suppose it examines motivation, responsibility, safety, and acknowledgement. And the men taking part are also taught mindfulness techniques to increase their self-awareness and to help with their own reactions. From those who have participated in the programmes and their partners, they really do see the benefits of them.
So did you speak to anyone then who's come through one of the programmes?
I did. Last week, Women's Aid was on News Talk detailing the harrowing abuse women are going through. The charity's figures show more than one in three have experienced psychological, physical and or sexual abuse from an intimate partner. So it was, look, on the other hand, insightful to meet with a man who once carried out this type of abuse himself. Due to having kids, he preferred to go by the name Joseph when talking on air. So Joseph is almost 40, and he openly admits that he was an abusive partner. He served a sentence for his assault, and it was through this that he came in contact with Move Ireland. We'll start off at the beginning of our chat, just to bring us back to the place he was in before going for his treatment, and just to remind people listening that what he recounts could be distressing.
When I was 7 years of age, so he was sexually abused in my home. So growing up, I grew up in Ballymun, disadvantaged area, wouldn't have had a lot. Probably would have been very, very angry growing up. I kind of bottled a lot of stuff inside and wouldn't talk to anybody about what happened. And in my later teens then, I started turning to drinking drugs just to kind of escape life, I suppose, and escape what happened. And unfortunately, that led into me late teens, and the anger was always there. Like, I was always lashing out on people and fighting and being abusive, I suppose. No matter who it was and what type of relationship, it could be a friendship, a relationship, I had to hurt everyone first because I was hurt, and I thought everyone was just out to hurt me, basically, you know. Got into me late teens then, I was taking a lot of cocaine and drinking a lot. Unfortunately then, when I was 23, I was sent to prison for 3 years for possession of drugs. Upon my release from prison, in 2011, I met my partner, and things were good, very good at the start. There was no drug taken, there was no drink. Shortly after that, then we fell pregnant to my daughter, so things were really good. But unfortunately, then as time went on and life challenges got in, true obstacles in my way, I turned back to taking coke and being angry and aggressive again, I suppose.
The childhood trauma, I suppose, would have led to the drugs. The substance abuse then led to the paranoia, the anger. But
yeah.
What do you think made it acceptable in your head then for that act or like the assault? Like, how come that wasn't a step too far?
Yeah, so when I was taking so much cocaine that I actually had psychosis. And psychosis is not something that a lot of people will, I suppose when you're taking drugs, a lot of people will get paranoid, but this is probably one step above that. You could actually physically see things in front of you that aren't there, that aren't happening. It's really bad. And I accused my partner of sleeping with my friend. I actually genuinely believed that at the time. Now when I look back, I know that it wasn't the case, but at that time when I was taking drugs, I believed it. We had an argument one day, and it was just purely in my head that she was sleeping with him, and I put my elbow up against her neck, unfortunately, and forcibly pushed it against her neck and said that I'll kill you and him. So obviously that's not good. There's obviously a lot of guilt and a lot of shame around what I done. There's no excuse. I don't excuse it in any shape or form, and I don't want to be sitting here saying, look, I was taking drugs at the time and it's excusable. It's not. They were my actions, and I had to step up and take responsibility for my actions. I suppose what happened to me growing up, it's not the reason why I done that, but it probably has a small part to play in the excessive drug use, you know.
News Talk reporter Josh Crosby is with me from the welcoming home party. What's the atmosphere like, Josh?
Oh, well, Dublin is alive with pride this afternoon. Look, the tourists must think we celebrate St. Patrick's Day every Monday. I'm standing here outside the GPO. This is just where the stage is being set up. And I'm looking down now, and it's just a sea of Irish flags. There are county colours there as well. I can see some Tipperary hats, some Donegal flags, Kilkenny, Carlow jerseys. People have come from near and far to welcome home Team Ireland today. And they have arrived. Team Ireland is backstage, as well as the Taoiseach Simon Harris. So you have rowers, boxers, swimmers, runners, gymnasts, horse riders and more. They're all here. And look, from what we've been hearing the last couple of weeks, it's just the inspiration this team brings people, that there's something for everyone. I was speaking to children here today, and they might swim, they might run, and it just encourages everyone into it. In Cork this evening, there's a homecoming for the Camogie team, but in Dublin, it's all about Team Ireland tonight. So let's hear from some of the families who've come out to support Team Ireland here today.
I'm just here with my daughter, Lily, and we just love everything about the Olympics. It just brings everyone together, makes everyone happy.
Come on, we have a walk up and I'll show you exactly what we're talking about.
Right, I'll follow you. So talk to you about the trade. What are the types of businesses operating here and how has it changed in recent years?
We have a proliferation of same shop usage in the vicinity. There's actually over 20 second-hand mobile phone shops operating on Moore Street. Obviously, the lack of variety in the shops and how poorly they're fitted out, that impacts trade because you need variety to attract a wider customer base. The problem is the tenants who occupy them shops are all only on short-term leases, so that would explain why you see such a poor fit out of the shops on the street. You can see there for yourself, you can see overlapping signages here, you can see multiple subdivisions of shops.
Talk to me about the subdivisions. So literally you'll walk into one unit but it'll be broken up into...
Yeah, how health and safety has allowed that is beyond me. I, on behalf of the business lines, have put in over 50 planning complaints to Dublin City Council, and it's absolutely incredible that they're saying they can't remedy the situation, that you don't need change of usage from retail to retail.
When it comes to footfall in and demand for a certain business, why do you think there's such quantity of similar shops in the one area?
I am flabbergasted, Josh, how over 20 mobile phone shops are operating successfully on Moore Street.
As I look around, I can count 15 second-hand phone shops open today, but Stephen tells me that some buildings are subdivided and there are also many more on the surrounding streets. They're not only selling phones, there are vapes, jewellery, beauty products and gadgets.
If you look at how poorly they're fitted out, you know, the visual amenity alone has been destroyed here on Moore Street. If something doesn't look right, people won't walk down it, you know. It's become a haven for antisocial behaviour because of the dereliction of the National Monument. We have multiple groups of people hanging around here on a daily basis. It's crazy. We recently had a visit from the Taoiseach down on this street and we had guards and everything for the day. There wasn't one person hanging around or there wasn't one person pickpocketing. And, you know, all the traders and the street traders are wondering, why can't that be done every day?
These shops are not just clustered in this part of the city. Almost every town is starting to see a similar type of outlet pop up. And it has to be said, there are, of course, genuine, reputable businesses operating in this space.
My name is Anthony Halpin. I run the vape club. I have two shops in Manor Street and Coolock, and I'm in the business since 2016. It's gone more into the people wanting disposable vapes, which the government should just ban them today, get rid of them, because I know I sell them, but I have to sell them because I'm a business, but I never, ever liked them. I was always against them. Any responsible vape shop doesn't sell to kids, you know, like, they think that it's all cowboys running vape shops when it's not. There is a lot out there, I will say that, but in general, it's not. People are responsible owners.
There are concerns raised now about the number of shops, say, clustered in certain areas. Like, is there enough demand for that level of supply?
I think it's just people just getting in, like, because the regulations, you have the likes of phone shops and all, we're competing against that.
Josh Crosby has been quantifying exactly how much this costs the HSE and by extension, how much this costs you and me every single year. So what figures are we talking about, Josh?
Well, look, it's big money, Kieran, when it comes to aids and appliances and the different types of walking aids that are out there, whether you're talking about crutches, Zimmer frames or walking sticks. I was actually taken aback when I started receiving these FOIs to discover how much money is being spent here. So last year there was more than 17 million spent on wheelchairs and walking aids. If you take Dublin alone, there was more than 15.5 million spent on wheelchairs since 2019. Even last year there was over 4.4 million spent. There's actually much more being spent in the north side than the Community Health Organisation, catering for all of Wicklow and the southeast of Dublin, so the likes of your Balls Bridge, Dundrum, Ranelagh. For example, there was more than 182,000 spent on walking aids in the north side last year, but then there was just over 14,600 spent on walking sticks and walking frames in Wicklow and a lot of the south side.
Okay, so I know kind of the north inner city and the north of Dublin, greater Dublin as well, the demographics are such that it's a much older population, so some of that would be explained, but that's a huge discrepancy. So 17 million, what did you say, 17 million in the year? That's almost 50 grand a day. 50,000 euro a day.
And these are not even the full figures, because there's still data there that from other counties as well.
Okay, so what about other counties outside the capital?
Yeah, so to take your part of the country, we'll say Kilkenny, you have CHO 5. This also includes Carlow, Southtip, Waterford and Wexford. There was more than 8.7 million spent on walking aids and wheelchairs last year. In my FOI request, I have figures since 2019, and you can see there was more than 28 million spent on walking aids and wheelchairs in that area alone since then. Just to get an idea of the different types of devices out there and how they range in price as well, I called into Phelan's Pharmacy and Mobility Supplies out in Stillorgan, and I met with Sarah Connolly, who's a specialist working at the mobility counter. Sarah says the prices can vary depending on the aids required.
So we have a huge range, starting from very basic crutch like the one here beside me, the chrome crutch, that starts at $29.70.
The horse is understood as a problem, not as a positive expression of identity, and that really has to be sorted out. So culturally appropriate housing, and not just dealing with accommodation in some generic way, as if you would with the general community, general population.
So that's Michael O'Flaherty, who's the Council of Europe Commissioner for Human Rights, speaking at the Joint Committee on Key Issues Affecting the Traveller Community. So the term culturally appropriate housing, it's something that many listeners might be a small bit puzzled by or possibly not even agree with, Pat. But like, when this debate has risen on the issue in the past, it can be quite difficult for all sides to understand. We know it became quite a heated clash between Tipperary Council and Travellers over a housing development outside Thurles at the time of the 2018 presidential election. People will say that they should be happy with what they're given. But then for the travellers, having a horse is a way of life, and they say it brings many benefits.
Now, Josh, have you seen any examples of where travellers and their horses coexist within an urban community?
Yes. So to get an understanding for myself, Pat, I took a visit out to Labrie Park in West Dublin, the first traveller housing site to be built in Ireland. As I walked up on into the halting site, there were lads out on their ponies and traps, vans pulling in with horse boxes tied on, a great buzz down in the yard section where they keep some of the horses. They have these shipping containers turned into makeshift stables. Then there's a plot of council land right next door that they let the horses out to roam on. I met with Paddy, who brought me around the site and told me all about the importance of having the horses nearby. And bear in mind for the listeners as well, we're standing quite close to the horses, so you might hear the odd noise in the background.
There's seven generations of us kept horses, and it's part of our culture, and it keeps the kids out of trouble here. Most of the kids here are mad into the horses.
Yeah, talk to us about where we are now. Like, these are kind of, I suppose, your own stables that you've made.
These are our own stables that we made out of containers. At the moment, like, they're temporarily stables, but sure, it's what we have made it up with.
Pie ball inside,
yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's a good pastime. It keeps the kids out of trouble, you know, and it keeps them off the streets, keeps them away from drugs, and, you know, like, it's the Oakham there, and they go to the old fairs, and they wash them, and feed them, and
yeah,
it's a full time job with the kids. Like.
So it becomes a hobby as well.
Oh, it's a hobby as much as the.
But you're lucky here where you are that you have this space.
We're blessed for to have this. You know, like,
not everyone would have the space allocated for.
No, we have the space, but we haven't got enough of space because we've too many horses here. Like, it's only a small yard. If you look at it, it's not that big of a yard, and there's 15 horses here. We're able to cope with what we have here now at the moment, but there's other horses out on land that we can't bring in because we ain't got the space for them. So we have to rent a bit of land. Come over here now and I'll show you what was meant to happen here out in Labrie Park Field.
Okay, right. I'll follow you.
We were meant to have the stables out here to the left.
Our reporter Josh Crosby has been examining this and he's with me now in studio. So Josh, what forms are people getting signed and what time frames are we talking about here?
Well, it really does vary, Kieran. So it'll depend on each individual patient, the type of form, and then, of course, how busy the practice is. So if you take a standard six cert for work, most GPs aim to have these turned around within 48 hours. But then when you move up the levels of documentation that might require a bit more analysing of the patient's records, you could be looking up to 3 weeks. I've been ringing GPs the length and breadth of the country to see what the average is on this, and around 2 weeks seems to be the going rate for most forms. But then if you need something like a PMA report, this is a private medical attendant report, it's used for insurance, this can take up to a few weeks because it's going back and forth between solicitors at the same time. But there are huge variations out there. Some say they'll have a cert in a few days or even on the same day if it's something like a social welfare cert. Some admin staff told me they can do most of that work. But what I did find out by ringing dozens of GPs is that it really does come down to getting an appointment in the first place. So let's say if it's a fitness test for driving or sport or something on the person's ability, then understandably the doctor needs to see you, and getting that appointment can be a waiting game. Just to get an idea of the pressures GPs are under, I met with Dr. Canute Moe from the Irish College of General Practitioners. Now, Dr. Moe works across two practices in South Dublin and says it's not just as simple as signing a signature.
Demand has been increasing year on year. We've been closed in one of our practices to new patients for the past 2 years to be able to meet the demand or meet the needs of our population. But certainly we're turning away 20 to 30 new patients on a weekly basis. And the reason for that is to be able to continue to offer a timely service for the patients that we actually have. At the moment, though, we've seen our waiting times increase from a same day service for the most part over a few years ago, probably pre-pandemic, to maybe a routine appointment being at least 3 to 4 days, and that's because we manage, but I know of other practices where you could be up to 2 weeks.
Since last month, all poultry and captive birds have to be kept indoors. The measure has been put in place to try and stop the spread of bird flu, also known as avian influenza.
Potentially there's two types, both of them are a big problem for us here. There's low pathii, which may or may not kill your birds, and then there's highly pathogenic, which will probably kill all your birds, and if it doesn't, law requires them to be slaughtered anyway. There's a very palpable fear amongst poultry farmers about disease issues, not just bird flu, but a lot of others as well. And the awareness has never been as keen as it is. We probably have the highest performing birds we've ever had, but also the most susceptible. So we have to be really on top of our game to stay ahead of this.
James Greaves provides technical assistance for poultry farmers and has worked in operations of all sizes around the world. We'll hear more from James shortly, but now I'm heading to a farm with around 100,000 chickens to meet with the IFA's poultry chairperson, Nigel Sweetnam.
Hello, I'd like to welcome you today, Joss. The farm here in Kinsale, we're on the estuary, 2 miles from Kinsale town. I'm a dairy and poultry farmer. I'm a broiler farmer, that means I get day-old chicks which arrived here on the farm yesterday, and we grow them for slaughter. We have 3 houses, 30,000 in each house, and big worry to us is the whole thing around bird flu, and that's why I'm talking to you today, because it's a massive issue for the Irish poultry industry.
And talk to me about the steps now that farmers such as yourselves have had to introduce since February.
Well, part of the work we did here last year, we put outside changing rooms. We have a foot bath and a wash station. Any dirty boots are washed, and any feet a foot dip before we cross the concrete apron.
Any good news at all in the county?
Well, Pat, I spoke with a man who would have been associated with the Mica campaigning, Paddy Diver. Now, they were protesting at the Engineers Ireland headquarters yesterday, and I met him. He's still living in a caravan, but he says they're starting to see some light at the end of the tunnel, but there needs to be more regulation.
We believe that when you buy a product, it should be fit for purpose. Simple as that.
So bring us up to today now, Paddy. We're standing here now where your house once stood, but what stage are you at?
I'm on a stage here now that my timber frame kit is up. I am now putting 50 mil battens on the outside and a cement board because there's not one block on my house. I do not thrust blocks anywhere in Donegal, and I don't trust the regulations, the market surveillance of the blocks. So I never want to see another block again in my life.
For many people listening, buying a house, building a home, it's one of the biggest milestones you'll ever do in your life. But to have to go through this a second time with a lack of trust in the materials, what's that like for everyone involved?
You can't put on to words, hey, because it's the most stressful thing ever. People turn around and think that moving a home is stressful in a marriage. Can you imagine tossing down your house and rebuilding it? Fair enough, we get people out there saying, oh, so you're getting a new home at the end of it. Never in my life would I ever have looked to swap my old home for this new home to see the stress I have to go through. I'm living in a caravan there now with my children. Bugs get into the caravan easier. My wee girl is crying petrified, doesn't want to be in there, can't wait to get back into her home, asking why did this happen, how did this happen? And that's the question that everybody's asking. How did this happen? When did this happen? There's still no public inquiry. There's still nobody being held accountable.